So today we're coming to the end of our series. It's the last message in our Mic'd Up series. And I was thinking, as we get to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, feedback time from you. What's one of the best or worst endings that you can remember or that you think of? It can be a book, it can be a movie, a TV show, it could be a job, maybe it was even a relationship, something that you're willing to share. You know, what's a great or horrible ending that you remember? I'll start you off. Any Seinfeld fans here in the room? How many of you love the finale of Seinfeld? That's right. Not a single hand went up. It was the most horrific, horrible series finale that was ever produced ever. Go back and redo it. So that was a worst ending possibility. Anybody? Okay, and here's another one just to get you maybe thinking. Any people watch the movie The Sixth Sense? Who thought that movie ended well? Loved the ending on that one, see? So, all right, your turn now. Any others that come to your mind? Books, anything? What else?
Animal Farm,
okay, very good. I have to admit, I don't think I had to read that one in high school. I know. I had a lot of others. So you're saying it had a great ending? There we go. Everybody agree with that? That read that book? Yeah, from what you remember. That's right. Anybody else? Good or bad ending?
I feel like Parks and Rec could have been better.
Okay. It was pretty rough. You know, sometimes TV shows, they just hang on about one or two seasons longer than they should. How I Met Your Mother, horrible ending. I mean, you can talk about all these shows. For the older crowd, Gone with the Wind. I mean, anybody remember that classic movie there? Great ending, right? Frankly, My Dear. Oh, great ending right there as he turns around and walks away. 2020.
Just the year.
2020. Oh, 2020 was a bad ending. Yes. As I was thinking about this, I turned to the great theologian Jimmy Fallon, who I thought could help us with this. And he does some hashtag stuff. Have you guys seen that before? He gets people to hashtag things. And so I picked up some of the worst things, and a couple of them were like worst ways I got fired from my job. And so put this first one on the screen here. So this one says, this is hashtag why I got fired. My friend used his iPhone to call the call center he worked at. Then he talked to himself for a couple hours to look like he was working. Hashtag how I got fired. I think that's creative, personally. He shouldn't have been fired. He just beat the system. Go to the next one. Hashtag why I got fired. My dad once called in sick, claiming there was something wrong with his eyes. When his boss asked him what, he replied, I can't see myself coming into work today. That's pretty good. Let's go to the relationship side of things here. Next one, how I got dumped. She told me to take out the trash and lock the door while I was outside. That's an ending right there, isn't it? All right, let's go to the next one here. My girlfriend asked me how to block someone on WhatsApp. After I sent the last piece of the instructions, I noticed I wasn't able to send her messages anymore. That's pretty bad. I left one out. Ryan reminded me. He and I were talking about him this week. There was another one that said, I once told a girl I didn't think things were working out as an April Fool's joke. She agreed. Those are some bad endings right there. You know, we've all seen them. We've all experienced them. And as I said, today we're coming to the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And you know, really, the Sermon on the Mount has been kind of this ride with Jesus. We start off with this very inclusive statement that's like, hey, let me tell you who all is a part of the kingdom. It's not who you think. It's for those who feel like they've been left outside, and I'm extending that invitation for all. And then there's like some really challenging teaching about, hey, you think you're doing okay just by not killing someone, but I'm telling you, if you have anger towards them, it's just as bad. And it's like, okay, Jesus, let's calm down just a little bit. That's hitting a little too close to home. And then he talks about worrying about, like, you know, stuff in life, and then talking about our treasure. And for the 21st century American, that is an absolute thing we wish Jesus would never talk about, because that's really all up in my business right there. And then he talks about judging others, and, you know, we could go on and on. And then he comes to the end, and really what we're going to find is when most of the time when you know, in public speaking world, a lot of times you want to bring people up and make them, you know, let's rally the troops as we get to the end. And really what you're going to find in the end of this message that Jesus presents is he's really kind of a downer. what he says is really a challenge to us. And you know, one of the things that I talk about here a lot at Ashworth is that I feel like, especially in the Christian world, we create false dichotomies that we have, that we put up to say, well, it's either this or that. You know, these things that we're kind of, we have to choose between these two limited or unacceptable options. You know, like outside the church, here's a list of some false dichotomies I came up with. America, love it or leave it. Really, those are our only two options. You love it or you leave it. You can't challenge it. You can't have a difficulty with it. It's you know, that's a false dichotomy. What about this one? If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Not really. You can kind of be an innocent bystander in some things, right? Sure. If you're not with us, you're against us. Is that always true? No, not at all. Go to the next screen here. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, I hope that's not true. That's a really poor thing to bring us together. Here's a couple from the church. God is either all-powerful and not good, or good and not all-powerful. That's typically the world's response when we see evil in the world. We don't know what to do with evil. We don't know how to process evil, so we go to number five, and we create that false dichotomy. Or this last one, you can either believe in science or faith, as if those two are mutually exclusive. So we talk about all these false dichotomies, and I will tell you, I resist greatly being put in a corner, being forced to choose. Ryan will tell you, if you want Brent to do something, you tell me to do the opposite, or you tell me not to do it. It's just my nature. I push. I'm a nonconformist by nature, and I just push back. Nobody puts Brent in a corner. And yet, thank you for getting that reference. What we see is when we come to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, is that this is exactly what Jesus does. He doesn't present to us a false dichotomy. He absolutely presents to us a true dichotomy. He speaks to us. He gives us a choice, and it's really an either or with no third option, and we're left to choose in Jesus' true dichotomy. So let's look and see, what in the world is Jesus talking about here? So we got a lot of scripture to cover to get to the end today, so hang on. Here we go. We're in Matthew chapter 7. We start in verse 13. Jesus says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only few find it." The final part of this message, Jesus comes at it from here on out with basically two approaches. It's like two choices. And he begins right here with gates and roads, and he lays out, he says, you know, here we can enter one of two gates. You have a wide gate, you have a small gate, because in that gate is going to get you onto one of two roads. It's either going to be a broad road or a narrow road. And there are two destinations that these roads are going to, destruction or life. And then there are two crowds that are going to be the ones that actually find it. And there's going to be one road where many people find it, and there's going to be one road that few people find it. And what Jesus is talking about here is a dichotomy of direction. It's a choice of direction, and it begins with the action that you and I have to take. Did you notice that? Because it begins with the word enter. Enter through the narrow gate. Now, Jesus is encouraging us the direction to go, because he's saying, look, there is a choice. There are two options out here, and you have to decide, but you have to enter, to move in that direction. And honestly, as we look at what Jesus is saying, is it really much of a choice? Not really. There's really not much of a choice here. I mean, because, well, it's life or destruction. Okay, how many of you are going, sign me up for that destruction path? That's the one I want. No, Jesus is painting this in a way to go, look, you really don't want that path. And yet still, and for some reason, he's telling us that this is still an option. And really, this passage presents a huge problem for 21st century thinking, because we do not like the fact that Jesus makes exclusive claims about how to come to him, how to find life. And there's no question, as you read these words and you read other words that Jesus says, he absolutely is making exclusive claims. What's funny is that others that say, you can't make exclusive claims. Well, that's an exclusive claim, but we won't talk about that. But this is exactly what Jesus is doing. In a culture, though, today that wants everybody to be happy, that wants everybody to live your own truth, where all paths lead to God, Jesus says it doesn't quite work like that. That's not how it is. Why? Because the entry point, or as Jesus calls it, the gate, it's Him. It's the difference in how we get to where we're going. What we enter through is what puts us on the right path or the wrong path. And what Jesus is saying here is it's really interesting because He says, look, there is a path out here. It's wide. It's easy. It's easy. The other one is not so easy. One is spacious. One, you can go with the flow. You can do whatever you want. Do all the things you want to do. You are your own boss. But on the other, and that sounds appealing. I want that road. I want that. But on the other side, He says there's a narrow gate. It's restrictive. It's demanding. It even calls us to come and die. Okay, how many of us? Oh, sign me up for that death track. That's the one I want. No. But it calls for us to have a radical commitment and surrender to Jesus. He'll show us how to live. And you really have to want to get there through this one. You don't just accidentally fall through this one. The other one, yeah, you can just kind of be swept up by the things of life and just kind of go with the flow. But Jesus is saying, no, there's a real intention about getting here, going through the narrow gate. And Jesus uses this imagery of Himself as the gate, not just here, but He uses it other times in John when He's talking to His disciples. In John 10:9, when He says, I am the gate, whoever enters through me will be saved. Or John 14:6, when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus here is absolutely making exclusive claims. To enter is to follow Jesus. It's a call that says, will you follow? And you only get to choose one gate. It's Jesus or not Jesus. And we're kind of forced with that. And again, we don't like that. We want Jesus and Jesus says, I'm sorry. And we don't like that. I don't like that. But Jesus is saying that. And we have to wrestle with that. And so what are we going to do? You know, and one commentary I read this week, I thought it was interesting because they pointed out, Jesus says, He doesn't say, enter the narrow gate by recognizing you are a hopeless, worthless sinner in need of grace. I thought, well, that's an interesting take on that. What Jesus is actually saying is He's showing how amazing He is. He's showing how awesome He is, what life looks like with Him. And He presents to us that to say, look, this is so much better than anything you could get. Why would you want to choose anything else? So that's the first one. Let's keep reading. Jesus continues on. He says this. He says, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. Then I will tell you plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evil doers. Here's what we see as a dichotomy of discipleship. This is a scary passage to me because it begins talking about prophets. We don't use that term very often today, but basically a prophet is just somebody who speaks on behalf of God, whose truth, divine authority kind of speaks to you. And false prophets, when they talk about false prophets, we also are implied that there are true prophets out there. And we see that disciples here, It goes from the prophets and then to disciples, because he talks about those that will stand before God and say, hey, but look at all the things I did for you. I went to church. I tithed. I taught Sunday school. I worked with the kids. Serving in the nursery has to be enough to get you into heaven. If there's anything in church world that does, it's got to be that. And so they stand before God and they say, I've done all this. And Jesus says, sorry. That's not what this was about. And you see, as we look at the prophets and the disciples, Jesus is highlighting that there are deceivers and there are the deceived, those who deceive other people and those who deceive themselves. And the Old Testament is full of prophets. You know, we've got like half the Old Testament is prophets telling people the message of God. And you also find mixed in there, though, a ton of the false prophets. What were the false prophets about in the Old Testament? These were the people that basically told the people what they wanted to hear. Well, they've been taken into exile, and the false prophets are like, oh, but it's okay. It's going to be over quick. And the true prophets are like, I don't think so. It's going to be like 70 years. It's going to be all right. God hasn't forgotten us, but buckle up, buttercup, because this is going to take a while. And the false prophets are just like, no. Let me tell you something to make you feel better. And that's basically what was going on. And you look at the way Jesus describes these false prophets, a ferocious wolf. That's scary. Somebody that pretends to be friendly. They look like us. They talk like us. And they seem on the surface like they can be trusted. And Jesus says, but you need to be discerning towards other people and towards yourself. Look at the fruit. Look at the fruit. What do you see? Not just by what's being said. Do you agree with what's being said? Anybody can stand up here and tickle your ears and tell you stuff you agree with. Anybody can stand up here and even spout truth of the Bible. But the real question is, does the life match what's being said? And I'm not saying this is a question of perfection. God knows that if you're looking at me, you're going to go, wow, there's some very weird, interesting fruit on that tree. So perfection is not the goal, but is there enough self-awareness and confession and repentance and dependence upon God that causes us to see that that message is trustworthy, that messenger is someone that should be followed? You know, we live in a celebrity culture. If COVID has done anything, it's taught us, if you want a better pastor, you shouldn't be here at Ashford. If you want a better speaker on Sunday morning, I think I do okay. I think Ryan does okay. I think Amy does okay. But I'm just going to tell you, if you want a better speaker on Sunday morning, there's a guy by the name of Andy Stanley. He preaches at a church at North Point Church in Atlanta, Georgia. He will knock your socks off. His gift is in public speaking. You know what COVID has done? It's shown people, oh, look, there are a ton of places that I can find teaching. You're right. Andy, I think, has the integrity to back it up. But it's bigger than that. It's deeper than that. Because sometimes what we have to be able to do is get close enough to those people to see if we can even tell what the fruit in their life is. And I'm not ragging on megachurches or anything, but if you can't be that close to the person that's dispensing the truth, can you really know, are they a wolf or sheep? I'm just saying that we need to pay attention. We can't be dazzled by the celebrity culture, by popularity, by how many friends, followers, or views they may have, by what they wear, how big their church might be. False teachers are never going to announce and say, hey, false teacher here. They're going to look just like the real deal. And in our culture, this is especially challenging when we live in echo chambers, when we circle up to find those who tell us what we already think. And even now, I hope that as you listen to me, I hope that if you may be saying yes, but I hope that you look at my life. I hope that you take what the pastors of Ashworth say and realize we are not exempt from this. Please evaluate us. Please have a discerning spirit to say, are they worth following? We're not exempt. You may know me, but you need to be able to look and say, is Brent living what he's speaking? And if he's not, there's a problem. Does the language match the life? It's more than what's being said. And when you go further, we begin to ask the questions. Do we see those people not just talking a good game, not even living necessarily with integrity, but do they go the next step? Do they show mercy to others? Do they live and care for the marginalized, the poor, the oppressed, the immigrant? When you see, what you see will reveal the heart and the character of the tree, and we need to evaluate that. What's most concerning to me and what's most scary about this passage we just read is what Jesus says, there are going to be disciples that think they're doing all the right things. I stood before, you know, they stood before God and they said, but didn't I do all these things? And he says, I never knew you. Now, I want to make this statement. I don't say that to scare you. I don't think Jesus said it to scare anybody. I think Jesus said it to an audience in a world that was highly religiously focused, that said, if you do A, B, C, all is good. And the entire message of the Sermon on the Mount has been, stop being religious. Stop worrying about doing the check boxes and marking things off the to-do list. That's not what it's about. It's about your heart. It's about your heart. Where is your heart? Who has your heart? Where is your heart focused? And again, Jesus is saying, "You're some of these people, they're going to get wrapped up in the doing, 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 doing. And in the end, they didn't take time to look and they didn't evaluate and they didn't say, who am I really following?" And it's fascinating to me that Jesus says, "Depart from me, I never knew you." To know someone relationally, to live in relationship. And that's exactly what Jesus was all about. That's what he was trying to get these people to do and to understand. Stop being so religious and focus on the relationship with Jesus. Let's go to the last one here. My favorite because it's the song some of us learned as a kid. It says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rains came down and the floods came up and the winds blew and beat against the house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice, it's like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rains came down and the streams rose. And the winds blew and beat against the house and it fell with a great crash. What we see here is a dichotomy of destiny. Like I said, if you grew up in Sunday school, you're very familiar with this. The wise man built his house upon the rock. Yeah, exactly. See, those who knew, yeah, we've been there. What's interesting about this is that you see what Jesus is saying is that on the outside, you're driving down the street and you see both houses. And on the outside, there's nothing that looks different about these houses. They're both nice suburban houses. They look great. Trees in the front yard, nice paint job on the house, shutters in the windows. All looks good. But what is it that reveals the true destiny of these houses? It's what you can't see. It's what they're built on. And the only way we really get to discover what they're built on is when the storms of life start pounding it. And the storms of life will. They will come at you and they will beat you over and over and over. And when you try to get up, they will beat you some more. And it's in these moments of life that you will determine what your foundation really is. When the storms come, you'll discover where your foundation is. And Jesus tells us there's two results here, two options. The foundation of the rock, the foundation of Jesus and his teaching and following him creates a foundation that is firm and that can last and that will stand. It doesn't mean the storms are any easier. It doesn't mean you don't feel every hailstone that beats up against your house. No, you do. It just means that you have the source, the foundation to make it. On the other side, you can have the foundation of sand. And when the storms come, it just leaves you empty. Questioning, turning away from God. You know, sometimes I think many of us feel like we're building a house of cards or this house on the sand, and we're like, okay, my faith, don't move. Okay, everything's fine. And then the slightest things come, and it just can all come crashing down. It's a terrible place for us to be. Look at this whole last part of the Sermon on the Mount. Go to this next slide here. I love this. You got three verbs on the left: enter, watch out, build on. You see the dichotomy that we're given. You can do the wide or narrow gate. You can be a true or false disciple. You can build on rock or sand foundation. But every one of these things comes down to one of two things: life and destruction. Life and destruction. Now, as I said earlier, I don't think Jesus was trying to make people afraid. I think fear is a horrible motivator, except in my house with my children. I think it's the best motivator I have. Putting the fear of Brent in my children is quite all right. I think one of the problems with the church is we go to passages like this and we rail on the fear. Where are you going? You should fear God. Can I tell you, if the only reason we have to follow Jesus is fear, we are following Jesus for the wrong reason. Period, the end. I hate fear as a motivator, because what Jesus is doing here is he's not trying to say, be afraid of what's going to come. No, what he's doing is saying, look, look, there is this world over here, and they offer everything. They offer beauty, and they offer fame, and they offer success, and everything that they show you says, oh, but this is the good life. And Jesus is saying, but I know, because I created this all, it's not the good life. It's going to leave you empty and wanting and hopeless. But look over here. And I know it's hard. I know it's challenging. I know it's difficult. But this is where real life is. And what Jesus is doing by saying this, he's trying to paint us a picture that says this is so much better. Why would anybody ever want to walk away from that, from him, to choose this? It's not about fear. It's about Jesus being just so much better than anything else this world has to offer. Last two verses. I told you we had a lot. Jesus, when he'd finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as the teachers of the law. Look at that. It says they were amazed. And we could look at that and go, wow, hearts were changed. It's not what it says. It says they were amazed. You realize you can be amazed by Jesus and not accept Jesus. You can be amazed by Jesus and still not be following Jesus. I think that's what we have to take away from this. Amazement doesn't equal acceptance or approval. And as I said, what Jesus is hoping here is he's not trying to dazzle us with his eloquence. He's not trying to show us, look at what a good TED talker I am. He's saying, look, I want you to understand what life in the kingdom is all about. And in doing so, what Jesus is doing is he's issuing to us a challenge. This entire Sermon on the Mount is a challenge, and it's more than a challenge. It's a call to action. It's an invitation from death and destruction to life, an invitation to follow him, an invitation to step out of the crowd and to be his disciple. And that's the same invitation we have today. And Jesus doesn't grab us by the neck and say, go this way. No, it's an invitation where he says, I want you to see. I want you to see the value in following me, and so that you will do it. And so for many people, we live chasing after what we think is important only to find out it's not. And Jesus is saying, don't get trapped in that. Don't get caught up in that. You see, unfortunately, I think even a message called a true dichotomy, we kind of resist a little bit. We want to live in the nuance. I realize I've become a much more gray person than I ever have been. It's not all black and white. I get that. But Jesus doesn't give us nuance here. He gives us something pretty straightforward. And this isn't the only time Jesus does it. John chapter 6, an incredible passage where Jesus is with his crowd, the people that are following him. These would be his disciples. And he makes this crazy statement where he says to them, he says, if you want to be my disciple, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And everybody thought, whoa, all right, Jesus, gone a little too far. And we're told in that passage, it says, on hearing this, many people walked away. They left. Jesus had asked for too much in that moment. Aware that his disciples were even grumbling about it, Jesus says, does this offend you? Do you want to turn back too? Do you want to leave? Peter says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We've come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. That's the challenge that we're faced with today. So as we close, this morning we're going to close with communion. And really, it's taking the words of Jesus where he says, eat my flesh and drink my blood. Literally. We have the representation, but it's here. It's the call to you. And this meal is not just for us to just go, okay, yep, I've done my religious duty. This is a meal for the true disciple. It's for the one who says, you know what, I see the choice, and I choose Jesus. And so this morning, I just want you to bow your heads for just a moment. And every time we do this, once a month, and even more than that probably, we should take a moment and pause. And we just need to ask ourselves, because the choice to follow Jesus is not praying a prayer of salvation one time 27 and a half years ago. It's a daily decision to wake up today and tomorrow and the next day and to follow Jesus. And before we come to the table, we need to pause and we need to say, yes, Jesus, your teaching is hard. The gate is narrow. The road is narrow. We choose you. We choose you, Jesus. We choose to follow you. Not because we're afraid of future eternity, not because we're afraid of anything, God, but because, Jesus, what you have and what you offer is so much better than anything this world can offer. And Jesus, when the storms come, we want to know that we've built our lives on you. We want to know that when we stand before you one day, we're not standing there in front of an unknown judge. We're standing there, and you open your arms. You say, man, I've known you for a long time. Welcome. God, thank you for this beautiful, beautiful picture. To remind us of the life we have in Jesus. There's nothing else in this world worth following other than him. I'm going to invite you to